You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. UK politics is experiencing a realignment, with the old divides of left and right gradually giving way to new fault lines based on social values, opinions on immigration, and a sense of national identity. That's the view of Dr. Steve Davies, who believes that the political parties of Britain are increasingly at odds with the electorate and even their own core voters. This situation has been exposed and exacerbated by the results of the EU referendum in 2016. According to Steve, a realignment in British politics is now inevitable. Today I talked to Steve about his theory, what it means for the UK, and how the two major parties will navigate these momentous changes over the next few years. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. Steve, good to have you back to talk a bit more about the philosophy of politics. Your realignment theory has gotten a lot of traction about how the political spectrum can no longer simply be defined between left and right, that everything is changing and people who were once categorized and easily put into certain boxes are no longer fitting in them. So you've spoken to us before about really global realignment, or particularly looking at the West, how politics are changing there. But I want to break this down a bit more today to look specifically at the UK, because obviously there's been a lot of chaos and turmoil, particularly in the two major parties, the Conservatives and the Labour camp. So what's going on? And are we at a breaking point? And what is shifting in the UK?
Well, the chaos, of course, has come about in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum. Now, the reason why it's had that effect is that that is really the breakthrough into mainstream politics of the new aligning issue, which a number of observers have now identified, which is the issue of identity, essentially, which has a number of secondary issues associated with it, such as immigration, membership or otherwise of the European Union, and broadly a division between cosmopolitan globalism on the one side and nationalism on the other. So we have the long-standing and the existing division between fans of free markets versus fans of greater economic activity by the government. But now, particularly since Brexit, we have overlaid with this newly emerging division between, as it's often called, openness and closeness, or as I would say, cosmopolitan globalism on the one hand versus increasing nationalism and parochialism on the other. And clearly, this maps very closely onto the Brexit vote. And the problem for both of the major parties is that both their MPs and perhaps in some ways even more importantly, their voters are deeply split over this issue of openness versus closeness, whatever you want to call it.
And how does that fit in with our former concepts of left and right?
Well, conventionally, we have tended to define left and right in terms of two separate issues. One which still exists is the one I alluded to, which is free markets versus state control of the economy, basically. The other one is a disagreement about cultural conservatism versus social liberalism around issues like gay marriage, gay rights, feminism versus traditional ideas about women's role and things of that sort. Now, I happen to think that that second axis, if you like, is exhausted. Social liberals have pretty much won the argument there. If you look at the figures, the overwhelming majority of the British public now are in favour of gay marriage, for example. Similar figures from other countries, but that's very true in the United Kingdom. Now, by contrast, research done at the LSE and elsewhere shows that on questions like immigration, for example, polarisation is actually getting greater. So the number of people or the proportion of the population who are prepared to say they think immigration is positive for the UK economy, positive for the UK society, has gone up. But at the same time, the proportion of the population who have very hardline anti-immigration views and who think that it's very bad for British society has also increased, and their views have become harder. They've tended to shift from the agree to the strongly agree end of the scale, if you will. So on that kind of issue, which is where we're talking about cosmopolitan globalism versus nationalism, the divisions are actually becoming more sharp and more severe, and we're seeing a kind of sorting out of the population. Now, the reason why this is problematic for traditional ideas of left and right is that quite a lot of people who have very left-wing views in economics, who favour nationalisation of the utilities, higher taxes on high earners, a major expansion of the state's role in the economy, are also, however, very nationalistic anti-immigration and anti-globalist, which are often regarded as right-wing views. Conversely, there are many people who are very free market who are also passionately pro-immigration, pro-globalist and pro-cosmopolitan. I would count myself in that category. So this second issue that's emerging cuts across traditional voting blocks. Now, you can see this most clearly with the Labour Party, where the great problem facing Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell and the Labour leadership more generally is that about 60% of their voters are very much on the pro-globalist cosmopolitan end of this new scale and also on the economically left-wing side. However, about 40% of their voters, while still very much on the left-wing economic side, very strongly anti-globalist, anti-immigration, pro-nationalism, and also in many ways very culturally traditionalist. And trying to keep both of those lots of voters happy at the same time is very, very difficult. Now, I have to say, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, in particular John McDonnell, have done a great job actually of managing to keep that very difficult balance so far. And they've done this by keeping the argument focused on the economic issues where their voters are broadly on the same page and trying to avoid confronting the difficult questions about Brexit and Britain's place in the world where their voters are deeply divided, but they can't keep doing that forever. The Conservatives, on the other hand, because they're in government, can't avoid confronting these.
No, because the Conservatives have to have a line on Brexit because they're in charge of leading those negotiations. One might argue that the Conservatives are still struggling to find their line on Brexit. There is still deep divide within the party. But the same pressure isn't put on the Labour government to come up with, in many ways, the foreign policy behind this, because it is a negotiation with other countries, and they're able to focus on the domestic issues, which have largely been abandoned, frankly, at least for the past year. But I would argue further than that. The big issues on housing and things like that just haven't been tackled.
This is absolutely true. And so we haven't had a proper argument. I mean, I was saying in a way that John McDonnell in particular is doing a good job of keeping the argument focused on economics to avoid the difficult choices. But having said that, there hasn't been that much argument about the economic policy. And so the kind of position that the Labour Party is adopting has not been subject to real public challenge or debate. Now, the Conservatives, in a way, have a slightly different problem to the Labour Party, which is that the great bulk of their voters are actually on the nationalist end of that nationalist-internationalist spectrum. However, a significant part of their vote is on the internationalist end, the more metropolitan, middle-class, affluent end of it. But crucially, their MPs in Parliament are split much more heavily towards the internationalist and globalist end of that scale. And that's why there's a significant mismatch between the Conservative Party in Parliament, I think, and the bulk of its supporters in the country, which makes their position extremely difficult. So both of our major parties are actually in a very difficult position right now. And the problem is that the divisions we have in Parliament and the divisions between the parties do not reflect the real divisions in the country.
Based on what you've just said, as the problems facing each major party, it sounds like the Conservatives have a bit of a tougher time. If Conservative voters are feeling split from Conservative MPs, that could have a very detrimental effect on the party, even if they don't decide to vote for Labour. If they don't show up at all, that could have a real impact.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, that is why the government, I think, as you quite rightly say, has not clarified what its view of Brexit is or what it's hoping to get from the negotiations. Having said that, the Labour Party, I think, will not be able to keep on avoiding this difficult issue forever. And therefore, I think that at some point in the next 2 years, probably just after the negotiations come to an end, there's going to be a major disruption. Now, it's hard to say how that will actually work out. It may be that the Conservative Party will double down on the strategy it actually adopted at the last general election and move to the left on economics slightly, very clearly towards the nationalist end of the other spectrum, and hope to win over that large block of working class voters who were voting for UKIP in 2010 and who seem to be at the moment homeless.
Yeah, let's go back to 2010 for a second and try to live in an alternative reality where there wasn't a Brexit referendum, where it just wasn't tabled at all. Do you think we would still be seeing a shift in alignment and in our political spectrum? You speak about UKIP, and obviously they were on the rise, and I would think that if there hadn't been a referendum, they might still be on the rise. So it's nearly impossible these days to talk about anything without including the context of Brexit. But is something bigger happening here? Even without Brexit, would we still be seeing these shifts and these realignments?
Yes, absolutely. I think that because of Britain's historic position as a country which has always had a rather ambiguous relationship with the EU, the issue of Brexit is the one that's brought this newly emerging division in society to a head. But there are other factors behind it. Immigration would still be an issue, for example, regardless of whether Brexit had happened or not. I think the issue of what you might call traditional British values and the challenge that the cultural left is posing to them would still have been an issue again, regardless of Brexit. And I think you're quite right in saying that had the referendum not happened, had David Cameron not, you know, punted a decision to the voters, basically, then I think UKIP would indeed have still been on the up. We would be seeing much more of a populist insurgency in that part of the British political spectrum than we now do, since the party is effectively, you know, dissolved, essentially.
Is it too blunt to say that had there been no Brexit referendum, we would have continued to see a rise in the populist right? But since we've had it, we're seeing a rise in the populist left as Jeremy Corbyn gains more and more support.
No, I think we would have seen a rise in the populist left as well. This is
Ying
something
to yang. Yeah,
I think both would have happened, actually. Jeremy Corbyn clearly, would have won the party leadership of the Labour Party, regardless of what would have happened with Brexit. And I think that actually we would be seeing a growth of a kind of economically left-wing but culturally very liberal populist movement at the same time. The difficulty for people like that down in the metropolitan area, the momentum activists and the metropolitan left, if you will, is that while their economic arguments play very well with working class older voters in, say, the north of England, Yorkshire, the northeast, their cultural agenda just does not go over, and it is perceived by those voters as condescending. They have a much harder road to hoe than I think they currently realise, because right now the collapse of UKIP and the travails of the Conservative leadership are giving them a bit of an easy ride, but I don't think that will last.
I want to talk a little bit about cultural alignments and realignments as well, because you mentioned at the beginning that in areas like acceptance of gay marriage, people have found more consensus. And, you know, that's good. It certainly feels, in America anyway, it's been remarkable how quickly people have moved past this topic. I mean, back in the 2012 general election in America, you know, gay marriage was a big, big topic. But once the Supreme Court decided to legalize it, I mean, this has pretty much fallen off the political agenda, in my opinion, in a good way. It's been accepted and everyone's moving on. It seems like that in some ways, it's not that the fight is completely won there, but there is a new set of cultural wars rising, and it's more related to free speech, Generation Snowflake, what's happening on university campuses, what's considered to be politically correct, who should have a voice, when should they voice it, whose opinions are more important than others. And here it seems like there's a lot of polarization, that we are not finding more consensus. So is this maybe not a realignment, but just a new kind of culture war?
Well, it's both, because essentially alignment means that there are certain big issues or clusters of issues, usually, around which all political debate and political alliances are organised. And what you're seeing here, as you say quite rightly, is the emergence of new issues, which in some sense have always been around. I mean, we've had arguments about immigration since the 1950s, but they've suddenly become a lot more salient, a lot more prominent than they were, say, even 20 years ago. And also greater polarisation around those issues. And I think the underlying common factor is identity. Now, because this is a largely new issue, therefore we haven't had time yet for one side to win a decisive victory, as I think happened in the older cultural wars about basically sexual morality, or for that matter for a consensus to emerge. So we perceive polarisation as taking place, and to some extent it is, but I think it's more a case of an issue which was previously around but not particularly salient is now becoming very, very salient, and so people are increasingly deciding, making up their minds where they stand on it. And that's perceived as being polarisation. Now, you mentioned a number of issues there. Apart from immigration, I think there are several other big issues. One of them is the whole question of the degree to which identity is taken as being given and natural, determined by things like biology, who your parents are, where you were born, culture you grow up in which case your identity is to a great degree something that's given to you and largely fixed, and the idea of identity as being something that is the product of choice. essentially, something which you can create yourself. Now, you can see this as its most dramatic and extreme, perhaps, in the case of all the arguments about transgenderism and gender identity, where there's a strong case being made now for a radically subjectivist and fluid notion or concept of gender and sexual identity, where it appears that your biological identity doesn't matter at all. It's a matter of whether or not you self-define as being male or female. This is in contrast to the arguments, the essentialist arguments, if you will, of a whole range of people, both from radical feminists to traditional conservatives, who argue for a much more fixed, definite and certain notion of male or female identity. But it's also happening in other areas, such as racial identity. We can all remember the case a year or so ago in the United States of the lady Rachel Dolezal, who it turns out was ethnically white but self-identified as black and had actually worked as a black activist for the NAACP for quite a few years while telling her colleagues that she actually was black. Now, that kind of gender and ethnic identity argument is another one that's really coming to the fore, along with a whole lot of arguments about what you might call historic identity, arguments about the status and value that we ascribe to things like Britain's imperial identity, our association with the empire, past important and even at their own time controversial figures like Cecil Rhodes and the like. And so I think we've got this whole new set of arguments of that kind, as you rightly say, which are now coming to the fore.
And again, to go back to that left-right spectrum, it's really hard to know where someone sits politically, how they'll sit in the culture wars, and which side they'll be on. You have a lot of people who would consider themselves to be on the left getting no platformed at events because they don't hold the right cultural beliefs. And similarly, I've met quite a lot of people who, economically at least, are on the right, who very much identify with more protection, say, around things like speech, which is on the other side of the culture war. So it's impossible now, I think, to define yourself into those traditional roles because there's so many aspects going on, and they're new, and we haven't come up necessarily with the right terms and definitions for them.
Well, that is what happens with realignments. People who used to be on the same side suddenly find that they're on opposite sides and vice versa. So, take a very good example. Julie Bindall, radical feminist, would definitely have seen herself and be seen as being on the radical left, I think, for most of her career. She's now being no-platformed all over the place because she's a critic of the whole transgender agenda. Similarly, there are increasingly a number of people on the left in this country and in other places like Australia and the United States who are arguing that the time has come to get back to old-fashioned class economic politics and junk all of the identity politics of the snowflake generation, as it's pejoratively called. So I recently read a book with the rather arresting title Kill All Normies, which was a brief account of the emergence of the alt-right in the United States and online. And the author argues that this is actually a side effect of the kind of transgressive politics that had grown out of the counterculture of the 1960s, and that basically she's coming, the author, from the very much from the American left. She writes for the Jacobin magazine. It's about as socialist as you can get. Her view is that you should, forget all this stuff and get back to good old-fashioned class politics and arguing about the economy, but actually move back towards a much more also much stronger emphasis upon the nation state as being the basic forum of politics and the instrument that you want to use to bring about economic change. Now, that's totally against the way certain other people on the left are going. So there are big ruptures going on, and similar ruptures going on the right, I have to say.
So to bring this back to the UK and to sum it all up, what do you think is going to define the next 5 to 10 years of politics in the UK? Is it going to be going back to this class politics? Is it going to be supporting or attacking this wave of nationalism? Is it going to be a populist agenda? Or are we going to go back to the good old days of politicians that were actually politicians, not reality TV stars with very blonde hair? What do you see being the defining factors of the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I do actually hope, and I am reasonably optimistic, that we're going to see a bit less of the politician's reality TV star, as you put it. This is actually one of the things I do like about Momentum and what's been going on in the Labour Party. This is an actual revival of actual grassroots politics, and perhaps the Conservative Party's biggest problem that doesn't get spoken about is it has almost no members. And that's something they really need to address. I think that really the precise form that politics will take will depend upon the outcome of arguments within the left and the right. And so within the left, it's an argument between an emphasis on cultural identity politics versus an argument for going back to old-fashioned and quite left-wing economic politics, class politics, with an emphasis upon nationalism and scepticism about in globalization, probably. Within the right, it's an argument between an emphasis on cultural politics versus an emphasis upon free market economics. Now, it's no way of telling how those two different parallel arguments will work out. But what I suspect will happen on the right, as conventionally called, is that I'm afraid I think you're going to see the emergence of a pretty dominant position in Britain, which will be broadly nationalist and slightly left of centre on economics. I think that is going to be where the centre of gravity on the right will pretty clearly emerge, because I think that's where all the electoral incentives point. On the left, it's much less clear-cut. It depends upon whether the part of the left that are in favour of arguing in class politics wins their argument. If they do, then I think we will end up with a really bad kind of outcome, I think, in which the two major blocks of voters will both be economically interventionists, and you'll have a very small third force of free market liberals. However, I actually suspect that, in fact, because of the way the electoral dynamics work, that that's not going to happen. And what I think will then happen is a lot more disturbance and chaos, in a way, on the centre left and, to some extent, free market right. And we'll see eventually the emergence of two forces, one of which will be essentially a kind of left-wing force that combines very radical left-wing economic policies with the kind of radical identity pluralism that I was talking about, plus cosmopolitanism. But at the same time, the emergence of a more broadly free market and strongly globalist and socially liberal force, which would then become the major alternative, I think, to the, I think, quite clearly emerging National Right Party.
Steve, that's an amazing prediction. We'll see how it pans out. Thank you very much. For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.